8%, LOL. Yeah, I'd love to get 8%. I invested in a landfill and got 0.00023% over the last 9 years. Haha, 8%, yeah, right. Helpful commenter. The S&P 500 has returned an average of 8%, including inflation, and you can invest directly in the market with index funds. Angry commenters. What? Really? Can you send me a link for where I can find out more about that? These people, these delusional people, have spent their time complaining on internet forums and spent decades paying thousands of dollars in interest. But they've never read a single book about personal finance. You can do better. When credit cards go bad, most people don't get into serious credit card debt overnight. Instead, things go wrong little by little until they realize they've got a serious problem. If you've ended up in credit card debt, it can seem overwhelming. Just think about when you watch Dr. Phil. It's so obvious to you, and you wonder why these people can't figure out how to solve their problems. Yes, you should leave him. He hasn't had a job in the last 8 years, and he looks like a rat. Are you blind? But when we have our own problems, the answers don't seem so simple. What should you do? How do you manage your day-to-day finances? And why do things keep getting worse? The good news is that credit card debt is almost always manageable if you have a plan and you take disciplined steps to reduce it. Now, almost nothing makes people feel guiltier than having credit card debt. 75% of Americans claim they don't make major purchases on their credit card unless they can pay it off immediately. Yet, from looking at actual spending behaviors, over 70% of Americans carry a balance, and fewer than half are willing to reveal their credit card debt to a friend. Those numbers are an indication that American consumers are ashamed of their debt levels, says Greg McBride, senior vice president and chief financial analyst at Bankrate. He told me they're more willing to give their name, age, and even details of their sex lives than provide the amount of their credit card debt. Really? Their sex lives? If this is you, let me know. I have a few single friends who might like to meet you. This shame means that those in debt often don't educate themselves on how to stop the madness. Instead, they fall victim to the credit card company's nefarious practices, which prey on the uninformed and the undisciplined. These companies have become very good at extracting more money from us, and we've become very bad at knowing when to say no. For example, the number one mistake people make with their credit cards is carrying a balance or not paying it off every month. Astonishingly, of the 125 million Americans who carry a monthly credit card balance, half of them pay only their minimum monthly payments. Sure, it's tempting to think that you can buy something and pay it off little by little, but because of credit cards' insanely high interest rates, that's a critical mistake. Let's say it again. The key to using credit cards effectively is to pay off your card in full every month. I know I said that casually, in the same way someone might ask you to pass the salt, but it's important. Ask your friend with $12,000 in credit card debt how it happened. Chances are he'll shrug and tell you that he decided to just pay the minimum every month. David Thomas, 32 years old, wrote, "I used my credit cards for everything and paid the monthly minimums. That plan left me with maxed out cards. I opened new 0% balance transfers to try to pay down the debts. Since I was so far over my head and I didn't have any emergency cash funds, I used the credit cards I had to pay for the things I truly needed. I wound up owing pretty much every major creditor you can think of and still do. The interest on my debt crushed me. Just because you have room on the card doesn't mean you have room in your budget." I'm not going to belabor the point, but you would be shocked by how many people I talk to who charge purchases without knowing how much they'll actually end up paying once interest is figured in. Paying the minimum on your credit card is like the grown-up equivalent of a little boy going to school and letting the school bully take his lunch money on the first day of school. Then he goes back with his pockets jingling every single day afterwards. Not only are you going to get your ass kicked, but it's going to happen again and again. By learning how the system works, though, you can figure out how to avoid the credit card company's traps and get out of debt much more quickly. The moment I realized I could pay off my debt, I asked my readers about the moment when they realized they could pay off their debt. Here's what just a handful of them said. Sean Wilkins, who's 39 years old, wrote, "The major turning point for me was when I got serious with my girlfriend. She made about a third of what I made, but she had about a year's salary saved up. I was ashamed to have $40,000 in debt, so I started applying the IWT principles to pay down debt and accomplished that inside 2 years. Dave Vinton, 34, wrote, "Debt was something I had gotten used to. My lifestyle was short-term and reactive rather than planned. I was so used to living paycheck to paycheck that I hadn't experienced the freedom of being able to make conscious financial choices. Now, money is a tool, not my slave master." Stephanie Ganowski, 27 years old, wrote, "Oh man, debt absolutely sucked. I remember crying about it multiple times. I had debt for all of in-state college, my $9,000 boob job, my $3,000 mattress, and my daily mall shopping spree habits. I was unhappy and clueless. When I chose to turn my life around, your book was one of the first I bought, and it really woke me the hell up. I felt wealth coming into my life just by reading it. Now I'm completely debt-free and started a Roth IRA." Justine Carr, who's 28, wrote, "I lacked confidence and felt like it was holding me back from taking advantage of all life has to offer. After reading IWT and now living debt-free, I have more confidence and spend money on experiences, people, and possessions that I value." Pay off your debt aggressively. If you've found yourself in credit card debt, whether it's a lot or a little, you have a triple whammy working against you. First, you're paying tons of high interest on the balance you're carrying. Second, your credit score suffers. Remember, 30% of your credit score is based on how much debt you have, putting you into a downward spiral of trying to get credit to get a house, car, or apartment, and having to pay even more because of your poor credit. Third, and potentially most damaging, debt can affect you emotionally. It can overwhelm you, leading you to avoid opening your bills, causing more late payments and more debt in a vicious circle of doom. It's time to make sacrifices to pay off your debt quickly. Otherwise, you're costing yourself more and more every day. Don't put it off, because there's not going to be a magic day where you win $1 million or you have enough time to figure out your finances. You said that 3 years ago. Managing your money has to be a priority if you ever want to be in a better situation than you are in today. Think about it. Credit cards' high interest rates mean you're likely paying a tremendous amount of interest on any balance you're carrying. Let's assume someone has $5,000 in debt on a card with 14% APR. If Dumb Dan pays the 2% monthly minimum, it will take him more than 25 years to pay off this debt. No, that's not a typo. It's really 25 years. And over the entire process, he'll pay over $6,000 in interest, more than the original amount he spent. And that's assuming he doesn't rack up more debt, which you know he will. If you're outraged, you should be. This is how people spend their entire lives in credit card debt. You can do better. Smart Sally, by contrast, is sick of her debt and decides to get aggressive about paying it off. She has a few options. If she pays a fixed amount of $100 per month, she'll pay about $2,500 in interest, making her debt-free in 6 years and 4 months. This shows why you should always pay more than the minimums on your credit card. There's also an added benefit to doing that, which is that it fits in beautifully to your automation system, which I'll explain in Chapter 5. Or maybe Smart Sally decides to pay a little more. Let's say $200 per month. Now it takes her 2.5 years to pay off her debt, including about $950 in interest payments, all from a tweak to her payments. Or what if Smart Sally gets truly aggressive and pays $400 per month? Now she'll pay off her debt in 1 year and 2 months, totaling just over $400 in interest payments. That's just from paying $100 or $200 more per month. If you don't have $200 extra, how about $50 or even $20? Even a tiny increase in how much you pay every month can dramatically shorten your time to being debt-free. If you set up automatic payments and work your debt down, you won't pay fees anymore. You won't pay finance charges. you'll be free to grow your money by looking ahead. In the eyes of a credit card company, you'll be a deadbeat. That's a curious nickname they actually use for customers who pay on time every month and therefore produce virtually no revenue for them. You'll be worthless in their eyes, which is perfect in mine. But to beat them, you have to prioritize paying off whatever you already owe. Julie Nguyen, who's 26, wrote, "I spent 4 years in college racking up debt that I was certain I'd pay off easily once I started working. I spring-braked in Las Vegas, Mexico, and Miami. I bought Manolo Blahnik shoes. I went out several nights a week. I had no idea then that I'd spend 5 post-college years paying that debt off. 5 years in which I could not vacation, could not buy fancy shoes, and could not go out very much at all. So on the day when I sent my final payment to my credit card company, I decided that that payment would be my last. I promised myself that I would never go back into debt again." 5 steps to getting rid of credit card debt. Now that you see the benefits of climbing out of debt as quickly as possible, let's look at some concrete steps you can take to get started. I Will Teach You to Be Rich is a 6-week program, but obviously paying off your loans will take longer than that. Even if you're carrying debt, you should still read the rest of the book now, because there are important lessons on automating your finances and getting conscious about your spending. Just keep in mind that you won't be able to invest as aggressively as I recommend until you pay off your debt. Yeah, it sucks, but that's a reasonable cost to pay for incurring your debt. Now here's what to do. Number 1, figure out how much debt you have. You wouldn't believe how many people don't do this and continue blindly paying off any bills that come in with no strategic plan. This is exactly what the credit card companies want, because you're essentially just dumping money into their pockets. You can't make a plan to pay off your debt until you know exactly how much you owe. Yes, it might be painful to learn the truth, but you gotta bite the bullet. Then you'll see it's not that hard to end this bad habit. In fact, you can get the credit card companies to help you. Look at the back of your credit card for their numbers, call them, and put their answers into a simple spreadsheet like this. You can add the following columns on a spreadsheet you might call, "How much do I owe?" The first column could be name of credit card. Then you could put total amount of debt, then APR, and finally minimum monthly payment. Congratulations. The first step is the hardest. Now you have a definitive list of exactly how much you owe. Number 2, decide what to pay off first. Not all debts are created equal. Different cards charge you different interest rates, which can affect what you decide to pay off first. Now, there are 2 schools of thought on how to go about this. In the standard method, you pay the minimum on all cards, but you pay more to the card with the highest APR because it's costing you the most. In the Dave Ramsey snowball method, you pay the minimums on all cards, same as the other option, but this time you pay more money to the card with the lowest balance first. That's the one that will allow you to pay it off first. Now, this is a source of fierce debate in credit card circles. Technically, the snowball method isn't necessarily the most efficient approach, because the card with the lowest balance doesn't necessarily have the highest APR. But on a psychological level, it's enormously rewarding to see one credit card paid off, which in turn can motivate you to pay off others more quickly. Bottom line, don't spend more than 5 minutes deciding. Just pick one method and do it. The goal is not to optimize your payoff method, but to get started paying off your debt. Sean Stewart, who's 31 years old, wrote, "I've saved over $3,000 and paid off over $3,000 in credit card debt. The idea of snowballing payments from the smallest card to the largest had the greatest impact on my mentality towards paying off the debt." Number 3, negotiate down the APR. I'm a huge fan of taking 50-50 odds if the upside is big and it only takes 5 minutes of my time. Accordingly, try negotiating down your APR. It works surprisingly often, and if it doesn't, so what? Just call your credit card companies and follow this script. You: "Hi, I'm going to be paying off my credit card debt more aggressively beginning next week, and I'd like a lower APR." Credit card rep: Why? You: "I've decided to be more aggressive about paying off my debt, and that's why I'd like a lower APR." Other cards are offering me rates at about half of what you're offering. Can you lower my rate by 50% or only 40%? Credit card rep. After reviewing your account, I'm afraid we can't offer you a lower APR. We can offer you a credit limit increase, however. You. No, that won't work. Like I mentioned, other credit cards are offering me 0% introductory rates for 12 months, as well as APRs of half of what you're offering. I've been a customer for X years, and I'd prefer not to switch balances over to a low-interest card. Can you match the other credit card rates, or can you go lower? Credit card rep. I see. Let me pull something up here. Fortunately, the system is suddenly letting me offer you a reduced APR. That's effective immediately. It doesn't work every time, but when it does, you can save a significant amount of money with a 5-minute conversation. Make the call, and if you're successful, don't forget to recalculate the figures in your debt spreadsheet. Chris Coletti, who's 33 years old, wrote, "I literally called the credit card company in the bookstore at the airport before buying the book. I read the script and I was able to negotiate a better APR. And they even credited the interest for the last few years back to my account. Only a few $100, but still, I bought the book seconds after hanging up." Charlotte S., 35 years old, wrote, "That first week I practiced my script. Then I called up my credit cards and had my rate dropped from 18% to 11%. Matt Groves, 31 years old, wrote, "Debt was awful. It was like a cloud over me at all times. I started contributing $100 more than the minimums and crushed that shit. I still have my paid in full notices saved." Number 4, decide where the money to pay off your credit cards will come from. One common barrier to paying off debt is wondering where the money should come from. Balance transfers? Should you use your 401k money or your savings account? How much should you be paying off every month? These questions can be daunting, but don't let them stop you. Balance transfers. Many people begin by considering a balance transfer to a card with a lower APR. I'm not a fan of these. Yes, it can help for a few months and it can save you a little money, particularly on large balances. But this is just a band-aid for a larger problem, usually your spending behavior when it comes to credit card debt. So changing the interest rate isn't going to address that. Plus, balance transfers are a confusing process, fraught with tricks by credit card companies to trap you into paying more. And the people I've known who do this end up spending more time researching the best balance transfers than actually paying their debt off. As we discussed, a better option is to call and negotiate the APR down on your current accounts. Taking money from a 401k or home equity line of credit. I don't recommend either of these options. You're trying to reduce complexity, not increase it, even if it costs slightly more. Again, there's the behavioral problem. People with credit card debt often find it difficult to reduce spending and end up getting back into debt after tapping their 401k or home equity line of credit. If you use your home equity line of credit to pay off credit cards, you'll risk losing your home if you run up more debt. Reducing spending and prioritizing debt. The most sustainable way to pay off credit card debt is also the least sexy. Unlike balance transfers and home equity lines of credit borrowing, it's not very exciting to tell people you decided to spend less on other things so you could pay off your debt. But guess what? It works. Let me ask you a question. Right now, for every $100 you earn, how much of it goes to debt? $2? Maybe $5? What if you paid $10 towards your debt? You'd be surprised that many people don't even have to cut much spending to pay off debt quickly. They just have to stop spending on random items, get conscious about making debt a priority, and set up aggressive automatic transfers to pay their credit card debt. I don't want to make this sound easy because paying off your credit card debt is challenging, but millions of others have done it. As you read the rest of this book, think of yourself as being on a little treasure hunt to figure out where to get the money to pay off your credit card debt. Pay special attention to these discussions that we'll have later in the book. The next $100 concept. Figuring out how much you can afford to put towards your debt using the conscious spending plan that I'll outline. The Save $1,000 in 30 Days Challenge. Setting up automatic payments. And my bonus resources at iwillteachyoutoberich.com/bonus. You'll notice that I haven't offered you a simple secret or cute soundbite about how to pay off your debt with no work. That's because there isn't one. If there were, I'd be the first to tell you. But truthfully, paying off debt just takes a plan and the patience to execute it. It may seem like pure agony for the first few weeks, but imagine the relief you'll feel when you see your debt growing smaller and smaller with each passing month. And sometime after that, you'll be debt-free. Then you can focus all your energy on getting ahead, investing, and living your rich life. Number 5, get started. Within the coming week, you should start paying more money toward your debt. If you find yourself taking more time than that to get started, you're overthinking it. Remember the philosophy behind the 85% solution. The goal is not to research every last corner to decide where the money will come from. It's action. Figure out how much debt you have, decide how you want to pay it down, negotiate your rates if possible, and get started. You can always fine-tune your plan and amount later. I'll cover more on your conscious spending plan in Chapter 4. Melissa Brown, who's 28 years old, wrote, "Being in debt means giving up choices, means staying at a job you hate because it pays good money, means not being able to build a decent savings account. My biggest mistake was not thinking about the future and using credit cards to live beyond my means. I got myself into debt in my mid-20s by spending, 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 and on stupid things like clothes, eating out, movies. I learned my lesson, and I'm now living within my means on a strict budget that will allow me to be debt-free in 2 years. All my debt is now on cards with APRs between 0 and 4.99%. I have a small but growing savings account, a 401k, and a plan to achieve financial freedom." Action steps, week 1. Number 1, get your credit score and credit report, which should take 1 hour. Check them to make sure there are no errors and to get familiar with your credit. You can access your report and score at myfico.com. As I mentioned, lots of people use Credit Karma to get a free credit score, but I prefer the official credit score from MyFICO, which is more accurate, even though it has a small fee. In addition to your credit score, get your free credit report from annualcreditreport.com. Number 2, set up your credit card, which should take 2 hours. If you already have one, call and make sure it's a no-fee card. If you want to get a new credit card, check out bankrate.com to find the best one for you. Number 3, make sure you're handling your credit cards effectively, which should take about 3 hours. Set up automatic payments so your credit card bill is paid off in full every month. If you're in debt, set up an automatic payment for the largest amount you can afford. Get your fees waived. Apply for more credit if you're debt-free, and make sure you're getting the most out of your cards. Number 4, if you have debt, start paying it off. That's going to take you about a week to plan, then start paying more. Not tomorrow, not next week, today. Give yourself 1 week to figure out how much you owe. Call the lenders to negotiate down the APR or restructure your payments in the case of student loans, and set up your automatic payments with more money than you're paying now. Getting out of debt quickly will be the best financial decision you ever make. That's it. You've mastered improving your credit by using your credit card. You've waived your card fees, negotiated your rates down, and even set up automatic payments. And if you have debt, you've taken the first steps towards paying it all off. Congratulations. In the next chapter, we're going to optimize your bank accounts. You'll earn more interest, pay no fees, and upgrade to better accounts than the worthless checking and savings accounts we grew up with. Once you've tackled your credit card and bank accounts, you'll be ready to start investing and growing your money significantly. Chapter 2. Beat the banks. Open high-interest, low-hassle accounts and negotiate fees like an Indian. Last week, you got your credit cards organized. Now, in week 2, we're going to get your bank accounts set up right. Since they're the backbone of your personal finance infrastructure, we're going to spend a little time picking the right ones, optimizing them, and making sure you're not paying unnecessary fees. The good news is this can all be done in a few hours over the next week, and once you do it, your accounts will basically run themselves. The bad news is that the bank account you have, probably your neighborhood big bank, is most likely a big fat ripoff with fees and minimums that you just don't need to be paying. You see, banks love average customers because we don't really want to switch banks, and they think we don't know any better about things like monthly fees and overdraft protection. With this chapter, that's going to change. I'll show you how to pick the best bank and the best accounts so you can earn the maximum amount of interest. Now, in any ordinary business, you'd think that the better they treat customers, the better they would perform, right? That's a reasonable assumption. Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos once said this, "If you do build a great experience, customers tell each other about that. Word of mouth is very powerful." Amazon grew explosively into one of the most successful companies in the history of the world. But then there are exceptions. Companies that seem to cosmically defy the rule that helping customers is good for business. Can you think of a company like this? Here, let me help with an example. Imagine a company that treats customers poorly. They levy onerous fees. They have terrible customer service. They even illegally open accounts on behalf of millions of their customers. What kind of company could this be? The answer, banks. Jamie B., who's 36 years old, wrote, "I hate banks as a matter of practice. I find them scammy, dishonest, and selective with their information. Their advice is always what's in their best interest, not the customers. I had a bank bounce my rent check because they seized money from my checking account to pay an overdraft in my savings account caused by a bullshit fee they charged me. It was $5. I had another bank accuse me of elder abuse when I was trying to manage my grandfather's affairs while he was dying of cancer. There is a special place in hell for that bank teller." I want you to go on offense right now and choose the right accounts. It's easy to do. Just look at the bank's past behavior. The good ones simply offer better services and no fees. The bad ones offer ever-increasing fees, unnecessary products, and they devise even more ingenious ways to screw you out of your money. But guess what? People already know this. They just don't care. People claim they want good customer service, but really, they just stick with the same old horrible banks for decades. The 30-second test. I have a theory that the first 30 seconds in a restaurant tell you everything you need to know. I remember waiting for a train in the Philadelphia Amtrak station, and I was starving, so I went into a deli. The employee at the door pretended he didn't see me and looked away. The guy at the sandwich counter walked into the back and didn't reappear. And I caught a glimpse of a third employee sitting in the back office watching TV. Three employees, a customer walks in, and they all vanish. Here's my theory. If your first 30 seconds in a restaurant are bad, it never gets better. This is the moment when restaurants put their friendliest, most charismatic staff out front to greet you. If they fail at that, who knows what's going on in the kitchen? The real lesson here is when companies and people show you who they truly are, believe them. Wells Fargo committed fraud and was fined $1 billion by federal regulators. Believe that they are a shitty bank that will screw you at the first chance they get. TIAA used to be a trustworthy investment firm. I even recommended them in the first version of this book. But after lawsuits surfaced alleging that they imposed heavy sales quotas and pushed unnecessary products, I stripped them from my recommendations. On the other hand, there are companies that consistently demonstrate excellent values. Schwab rolled out a phenomenal high-interest checking account years ago that offered unrivaled benefits for free. They've honored it and improved it over time. I trust them, and I have a checking account with them. Vanguard has consistently demonstrated a long-term focus on low costs and putting their clients first. They actually proactively lower their fees. I trust them, and I invest with them. I share this because I want you to start becoming discerning about the companies you work with. This is your money. It's important. You should judge the companies you work with on their values and how they treat you. Nathan P., who's 35 years old, wrote, "In my experience, if you are poor or just getting started, banks are basically out to screw you over. I remember tracking my balance down to the nearest dollar to avoid overdraft fees. I'm now able to keep a healthy buffer in my checking account, but starting out, it was a constant source of anxiety to make sure I didn't get hit with double whammy fees. An example is an overdraft that hit for less than $5, but I was then charged each time my account was pinged. I ended up with $100 in overdraft fees for going over $5. Jessica Denham, 42 years old, wrote, "I hate Wells Fargo. I had a passbook savings account as a kid, and as a destitute young adult, I remembered that $16. I could use it to buy groceries. Turns out they had absorbed the entire amount through fees after I turned 18 and then closed the account. Robbed a child's piggy bank, stole a young person's grocery bag, and lost a high-income customer for life over $16. Nice work, Wells Fargo." Alan Nash, 28 years old, wrote, "While I was on a trip, Bank of America charged me overdraft fees when my account wasn't overdrawn and kept going until $800 in fees were accumulated, then attempted to sue me over the money." You already know these big banks are trying to screw you for all the money they can get out of you. Not only do they levy fee after fee, they launch marketing campaigns to trick customers into signing up for services they don't need and which, if they understood the terms, they would never agree to. Shit, Wells Fargo fraudulently opened accounts for 3.5 million people. In fact, as Forbes reported, Wells employees opened 1,534,280 unauthorized deposit accounts, 85,000 of which accrued a total of $2 million in fees. Those fake accounts didn't just hurt customers' credit scores. CNN reported Wells Fargo admitted to forcing up to 570,000 borrowers into unneeded auto insurance. About 20,000 of those customers may have had their cars repossessed due to these unnecessary insurance costs. Just imagine the type of people who had their cars repoed because Wells Fargo screwed them over. We're not talking about hedge fund titans living in Manhattan. We're talking about ordinary people. Bridget Sally, who's 26 years old, wrote, "Bank of America institutes new fees for what seems to be no reason, sometimes unexpectedly, like $5 maintenance fees on savings accounts. It's not like the interest offered is even worth it. Not to mention their $12 fee for checking accounts that don't have deposits of $250 or more. I know the amount seems small, but I know that for some people, $5 to $12 is a lot of money and can be the difference in paying bills. It always seems like those with the lowest balances end up paying the price." This infuriates me. I absolutely hate when sophisticated financial firms take advantage of people who don't understand the complexity of these financial products. That's why I wrote this book, and that's why I'm sharing these stories with you. And yet people still stick with banks who have proven bad patterns of behavior. I got curious. I asked some of my readers who'd chosen to stay with horrible banks like Wells Fargo or Bank of America, why? Their answers? "I've been with Wells Fargo for like 20 years, so it's just one of those things where it's always been that way and I don't think about it." Another reader said, "I have 8 accounts with Wells Fargo, and although I hate them and what they stand for, the idea of moving those accounts seems like a gigantic, annoying time suck." And finally, "I've changed banks before, but it was a struggle to get the ball rolling. It's almost like an emotional attachment." This person literally said they have an emotional attachment to a multi-billion dollar bank. This is a serious quote. I can't believe it. "No matter how many times I say to switch to a better bank, most of my readers just don't give a shit. It's fine. Stay with the bank that's going to open fake accounts under your name, charge you near extortionate fees, and figure out a way to screw you today or 5 years from now. Whatever. God." On the other hand, the people who did follow my recommendations in this chapter universally loved it. Rick McClelland, who's 27 years old, wrote, "I've been with Schwab for years thanks to your recommendation. Service is always great. The few problems I've had are always cleared up." Rehan Anwar, 29 years old, wrote, "I switched to Schwab years ago based on your recommendation and haven't looked back." And Saad Ghul, 42, wrote, "On your recommendation, I moved to Schwab. I use them all over the world, including in Pakistan, at what claims to be the world's highest ATM. Why haven't you switched banks yet? Invisible money script. It's a headache to switch banks. What it means. Honestly, I get it. You've got your account set up and it works. Why not just stay? My analysis? You don't have to switch, but if you spend about one day doing it, you'll ensure that the foundation of your financial system is solid. The banks I recommend are more convenient, cheaper, and often offer better rewards than big banks. As you grow your income, you'll know you're working with the best. Invisible money script. I don't know where else I would go. What it means. This is irrelevant. Just listen to the rest of this chapter and I'll tell you the best banks. Invisible money script. This was my first bank ever. What it means. I only heard this once, but it was so ridiculous that I had to include it in this book. Do you have a lifelong love of your first thumbtack? What about your first garden hose? No? So why are we talking about how you cuddle up with your first bank ever? Get the fuck out of here. How banks rake it in. Fundamentally, banks earn money by lending the money you deposit to other people. For example, if you deposit $1,000, a big bank pays you a small amount in interest to hold on to that money, then turns around and lends it out at a much higher percent for, say, a home loan. Assuming that everyone repays their loans in full, the bank makes a huge return on their money for simple arbitrage. But here's how they really make tons more money. Fees, fees, fees. In 2017, banks made more than $34 billion in overdraft fees alone. For example, if you're using a debit card and accidentally buy something for more money than you have in your checking account, you'd expect your bank to decline the charge, right? Nope. They let the transaction go through and then helpfully charge you around $30 for an overdraft fee. Even worse, banks can charge you multiple overdraft fees in one day, leading to horror stories of more than $100 in fees levied in one day alone. No more overdrafts. One overdraft fee wipes out your interest for the entire year and makes you hate your bank more than you already do, if that's even possible. More than half of the people I've spoken to during my personal finance talks have had at least one overdraft. One night, I was out for dinner and my friend, let's call her Elizabeth, started asking me questions about overdrafts. These questions got increasingly complex, which weirded me out because I wondered how she knew so much about them. Then I asked her a simple question. How many overdrafts have you had? She got quiet, which of course made me want to interrogate her more. Welcome to my twisted mind. I learned that she'd incurred more than $400 in overdraft fees over 4 years of college by simply not paying attention to how much money she had in her account. The sad thing is that she could have negotiated her way out of the first few fees and then set up a system so it never happened again. Remember, your bank's fees can be more important than the interest rate it offers. If you have $1,000 and another bank has a 1% higher interest rate, that's a difference of $10 per year. Just one overdraft fee equals 3 times that amount. Costs matter. The nuts and bolts. Now that I've got my bank rants out of the way, let's go over a few account basics. You may think you know all this stuff, and a lot of it you probably do, but bear with me. Checking accounts. Your checking account is the backbone of your financial system. It's where your money will go first before it's filtered to different parts of your system, like your savings account, your investing account, and your guilt-free spending. This is why I believe in picking the best account, then moving on. Now, before we go on, I just want to say that as I've taught this to more and more people, inevitably, I get people saying, yeah, I know you recommended this specific account, but what about this obscure, tiny, never before heard of account that I have in this tiny, obscure city, in this tiny, obscure state? Can I still use that? Listen, guys, you can use whatever you want. It's your personal finance system. But as we go through the rest of the chapters in building our financial infrastructure, you're going to find that I build on the tools that I recommend early on in this book. So you might feel personally aligned to your bank for some odd reason. You might simply have a fear of change. Whatever the case may be, I would strongly encourage you to stick to the system. If you have a strong reason for deviating, fine. It's your system. You can decide what to do with it. But for all other reasons, follow the system. When you do that, you're going to be setting yourself up to take advantage of all the awesome automation stuff that I'm going to teach you in upcoming chapters. Now, as you know, checking accounts let you deposit money and withdraw money using debit cards, checks, and online transfers. I think of my checking account like an email inbox. All of my money goes into my checking account, and then I regularly apportion it out to appropriate accounts like saving and investing using automatic transfers. I pay most of my bills through my credit card, but the bills that I can't pay with my card, like rent or my car payment, I pay directly from my checking account using automatic transfers. I'll show you how to automate all this stuff in Chapter 5. Checking accounts are the number one place where unnecessary fees are levied, and we're going to change that. Savings accounts. Think of savings accounts as places for short-term, like 1 month, to mid-term savings, around 5 years. You want to use your savings account to save up for things like vacation and holiday gifts, or even longer-term items like a wedding or the down payment on a house. The key difference between checking and savings accounts is this. Savings accounts technically pay more interest. I say technically because on a practical level, the interest on your savings account is essentially meaningless. In the last edition of this book, I included a chart that showed you what you earned in interest at big banks versus online banks, which offer higher rates. Then, because interest rates change, I proceeded to get literally thousands of emails over 10 years asking frantically where the interest rates from the book were. Guys, I have learned two things from this. First, I am never, ever including interest rates in a book again. Second, I failed to explain why the interest rate on your savings account is not all that important. Let's just assume for a minute that you have $5,000 sitting in a savings account as part of your emergency fund. If your bank offers you a 3% interest rate, that's $150 a year. You know how much that is per month? $12.50. If instead your bank offers you a 0.5% interest rate, that's $25 per year, or $2.08 per month. In short, who gives a shit? Why are we even talking about this? $12.50 versus $2? I don't want to talk about this ever again. We're talking about hundreds of thousands of dollars, even millions. Start having $30,000 conversations, not $3 conversations. Interestingly, if we're getting technical, many people actually lose money every day their money is sitting in savings, since inflation erodes the real purchasing power of your cash. That's why the bulk of your wealth will be made from investing, which I cover in Chapter 7. If you learn only one thing from this book, it should be to turn your attention from the micro to the macro. Stop focusing on picking up pennies and instead focus on the big wins to craft your rich life. Now that I've set my investment accounts up and automated them, do you know that the amount I earn from 1 year of investing is worth more than 500 years of interest in a savings account? You heard that right. Don't worry about micro-optimizing your bank account interest rates. Just pick great bank accounts and move on. Joe Lara, who's 29 years old, wrote, "Before I read IWT, my personal finances were in shambles, and all my money was escaping me through late fees, overdraft fees, and credit card annual fees. After reading this book, I was able to automate my finances to eliminate overdraft and late fees. By applying your strategies, I moved into a better place and doubled the amount I paid towards my debt every month." Jonathan Boz, 24 years old, wrote, "Before reading your book, I had all my savings lumped into one Chase savings account and no investments. The burden of choice was holding me back from opening any new accounts and starting to invest." Why you need both a savings account and a checking account. The most important practical difference between checking and savings accounts is that you withdraw money regularly from your checking account, but you rarely withdraw from your savings account. Checking accounts are built for frequent withdrawals. They have debit cards and ATMs for your convenience. But your savings account is really a goals account where every dollar should be assigned to a specific item you're saving up for, like a house or an emergency fund or even a vacation. You might think I'd encourage you to have your checking account and savings account at the same place. But surprisingly, I recommend two different accounts at two separate banks. Here's why. Having your money in two separate accounts and banks uses psychology to keep your savings growing. One basic way of looking at it is that your savings account is where you deposit money, whereas your checking account is where you withdraw your money. In other words, if your friends want to go out on Friday night, you're not going to say, hold on, guys, I need 3 business days to transfer money to my checking account. If you don't have the money available in your checking account because you've spent your going out money, guess what? You'll know it. Having a separate savings account forces you to keep your long-term goals in mind instead of just blowing them off to have a few rounds of drinks. Finally, in my experience, have you ever bought a printer that was an all-in-one printer? It had a printer, a scanner, it cooked your omelets in the morning. It's horrible at everything. That's the same with banks. Banks that try to offer checking and savings and investing tend to be mediocre at all of them. I want the best checking account and the best savings account and the best investment account, and they all happen to be in different places. Right now, you might be saying to yourself, why should I bother with a savings account? I only have $300. I hear this all the time. It's true. The interest you'll be earning on that kind of money really isn't that much. But it's not just about your immediate earnings. It's about developing the right habits. I remember once asking my readers why they hadn't yet made certain decisions, like switching bank accounts or automating their investments. One guy told me that his amounts were so small, it didn't really matter. To me, that's actually the perfect time to start, when the stakes are low. Build the right habits when the amounts are small, with the right accounts, the automatic saving, and the automatic investing, so that when your income increases, your habits are rock solid. Sure, right now we're cutting our teeth with small amounts. But as our savings accounts increase from $5,000 and $10,000 to $100,000 to $1 million and beyond, the habits really start to matter. Start now, so that when you do have a lot of money, you'll know exactly what to do with it. Roxana Valentina, who's 27 years old, wrote, "Before, all my money went to shopping, paying my debt, and my credit card. I never saved. I always felt that I wasn't making enough, and maybe, just maybe, if I earned more, I would start saving and be in a good financial situation. But I was wrong. No matter how much money I made, if I didn't have a plan, I would always feel like I had insufficient money. 4 months later, no debt for me. I have a savings account, and I also started investing. I feel so much better, and I can focus on improving my life in general, since one of the most important pillars in my life is on a good track." Finding the perfect account setup. I'll tell you my favorite accounts in a few minutes, but before you go about finding the specific banks and accounts you want to use, take a minute to consider the big picture. You want to pick accounts that work well with your personality. So you have to know yourself. Do you value simplicity? Or are you the kind of person who wants to spend time building a complicated system for a slightly larger payout? For most people, another option, basic option plus small optimization, is perfect. Here's the most basic option, which is good for lazy people. Get a checking account and a savings account at any local bank. This is the bare minimum. Even if you already have these accounts, it's worth talking to your bank to make sure you're not paying any fees. Now here's another option that I recommend for most people. It's a basic option plus a small optimization. This option means opening accounts at 2 separate institutions, a no-fee checking account at your local bank and a high-yield online savings account. With the checking account, you'll have immediate access to your money and free cash transfers to your high-interest online savings account. You can also deposit cash through your local bank. If you already have this set up, great. Just call to make sure you're not paying any unnecessary fees. And then there's the advanced setup. This is perfect for people who read things like Life Hacker and the 4-Hour Workweek. It also includes full optimization. This setup consists of maintaining several checking accounts and savings accounts at different banks, usually to eke out the most interest and services that various banks have to offer. For example, I have an interest-bearing checking account at an online bank, and a savings account at a different online bank. Although you can set up automatic transfers, having multiple banks means multiple websites, multiple customer service numbers, and multiple passwords. Some people find this overly complicated. And if you're one of them, stick to a more basic setup unless it's very important to you to fully optimize your bank accounts. Personally, I think this option is awesome. How my bank accounts work. Here are the bank accounts I use and how I've set them up to work together. My accounts. All my money goes through my interest-bearing Schwab online checking account. Deposits happen through direct deposit or by taking a photo of a check and depositing it through the Schwab app. My system. My finances work on a monthly cycle, and my system automatically disburses money where it needs to go. I've set up accounts to draw from my checking account. For example, my Capital One 360 savings account automatically withdraws a certain amount every month from my checking account, as does my investment account, which I'll cover more about in Chapter 3. For rewards, tracking, and consumer protection, I pay my bills using my credit card. The credit card is automatically paid in full every month by my online checking account. For cash expenses, I use the Schwab ATM card to withdraw money at any ATM across the country. All ATM charges are automatically reimbursed at the end of the month. Generally, I use my Capital One 360 savings account as a receiver, not a sender. I rarely transfer money out of it and mostly send money in unless I need to cover a temporary shortage in my checking account or I want to spend my savings money on something important like a vacation. And that's how I do it. So many choices, so little time. Depending on what accounts you already have and what setup you've opted to go with, getting this part of your financial infrastructure squared away may be as easy as making small changes to accounts you've had for a while. Or you may need to open new accounts, which can be pretty overwhelming. As usual with financial decisions, we have too many options, leading most of us to make less than ideal choices, like opening bank accounts in college and then staying with that bank forever. There's some good accounts out there, but of course, banks don't make those deals easy to find. Most traditional banks offer different checking and savings accounts to serve customers with different needs and amounts of money. They start at student accounts, which are bare bones accounts with no fees, no minimums, and very few value-added services. These are generally perfect for young people. Next, they offer accounts that have nominal monthly fees. They also offer ways for you to get these fees waived, like using direct deposit, where your paycheck is automatically sent to your bank every month, or maintaining a minimum balance. If your employer offers direct deposit, these accounts might be a good choice. Finally, banks offer higher-end accounts with higher minimums, often $5,000 to $10,000, and more services, like commission-free brokerage trades, which you should avoid since banks are the last place you should invest, or bonus interest rates or discount on home loans. These accounts are completely worthless. Avoid them. If you have that much money lying around, I'll show you how to put it to work in Chapter 7 and earn more than any bank could give you. You should research the options at a few different banks. You can compare these banks in less than an hour by going to their websites, or you can just use the banks I use, which I'll tell you about in just a minute. Beyond just the type of accounts offered, there's more to consider when choosing your banks. I look for three things: trust, convenience, and features. Trust. For years, I had a Wells Fargo account because their ATMs were convenient, but I don't trust big banks anymore. I especially don't trust Wells Fargo, and I'm not the only one. Perhaps it's because they secretly insert fees, like the filthy double charges for using another bank's ATM, then count on our inaction to make money off us. There are still some good banks out there, though. The best way to find one is to ask friends if they have a bank they love. You can also browse the major banks' websites. Within about 5 minutes, you'll be able to tell which banks are trustworthy and which are not by seeing how straightforward they are with their accounts and fees. Your bank shouldn't nickel and dime you through minimums and fees. It should have a website with clear descriptions of different services, 24/7 service by phone. And another thing, ask them if they send you promotional material every damn week. Listen, I don't want junk mail. I don't want mail at all for that matter. And I definitely don't need your stupid cross sells. I remember I actually switched my car insurance years ago because they wouldn't stop mailing me stuff 3 times a week. Go to hell, 21st century insurance. Convenience. If your bank isn't convenient, it doesn't matter how much interest you're earning. You're not going to use it. Since a bank is your first line of defense in managing your money, it needs to be easy to put money in, get money out, and transfer money around. This means its website has to work, and you need to be able to get help when you need it, whether by email or by phone. Features. The bank's interest rate should be competitive. Transferring money around should be easy and free because you'll be doing a lot of it, and you should have free bill paying. Their app or website should be something you actually enjoy using. What about credit unions? I used to be a big fan of credit unions. I love their mission, and I recommended them in the first edition of this book. I even spoke at a national credit union conference years ago. Credit unions are like local banks, but they're not for profit, and they're owned by their customers, or in credit union parlance, members. Theoretically, this means they offer better service. Unfortunately, I've changed my opinion about credit unions. Their constant navel-gazing, let me give you a painstaking explanation of why being member-owned is better. Wait, come back! Instead of delivering solutions and features that my readers actually care about, is a disappointment. Credit unions squandered a generational opportunity to position themselves against predatory and scammy banks like Bank of America and Wells Fargo. In the future, I genuinely hope this changes. 5 shiny marketing tactics banks use to trick you. Number 1, teaser rates, like 6% for the first 2 months. Don't get sucked in by this trick. Your first 2 months don't matter. You want to pick a good bank that you can stick with for years. One that offers overall great service, not a promo rate that's only going to earn you $25, or more likely $3. Banks that offer teaser rates are by definition to be avoided. Number 2, requiring minimum balances to get free services like checking and bill paying. No, I'm not going to agree to a minimum amount. I'll just go somewhere else. Number 3, upsells to expensive accounts like expedited customer service. Wow! Most of these value-added accounts are designed to charge you for worthless services. I can't wait to have kids one day so my 3-year-old can walk into a Wells Fargo, throw his lollipop at the bank manager, and scream, "This account is clearly a ripoff!" Good job, little Raj. Number 4, holding out by telling you that the no-fee, no-minimum accounts aren't available anymore. They are. Banks will resist giving you a no-fee, no-minimum account at first, but if you're firm, they'll give you the account you want. If they don't, find another bank. There are many, many choices, and it's a buyer's market. Number 5, bundling a credit card with your bank account. If you didn't walk in specifically wanting the credit card, don't get it. Don't be a rate chaser. Do me a favor. If your bank account offers one rate and another bank starts offering a slightly higher rate, don't change accounts. Half the time, these rates are simply introductory teaser rates that'll drop after 6 months. I'd rather take a slightly lower interest rate if it's at a bank I can trust to give me great service over the long term. But there are a lot of dorks, especially online dorks who live on Reddit, who spend every waking hour digging up the best interest rates and switching to it immediately. Oh my God, they say, Ally Bank increased its rate from 2.25% to 2.75%. Now it's 0.02% higher than Capital One 360. I'm going to switch accounts right now. If you do this, you are a moron. Do you really want to spend each month figuring out which bank is offering a slightly better rate? That's a colossal waste of time for most of us, since a 0.5% difference equals just a few dollars per month more in interest. Plus, interest rates change over time, so rate chasing doesn't even make sense. I plan on sticking with my bank for the next few decades, and I'm sure you have better things to do with your time. So focus on the big wins, not on rate chasing. The best accounts, including the ones I use. As we've seen, a lot goes into finding the right accounts. Here are a few options that I've found work well for many people, along with my personal picks. Checking accounts. Schwab Bank Investor checking account with Schwab One brokerage account. This is the account I use. In my opinion, this is the single best checking account available. Schwab offers a stunningly good account with no fees, no minimums, no fee overdraft protection, free bill pay, free checks, an ATM card, automatic transfers, and best of all, unlimited reimbursement of any ATM usage. This means you can withdraw from any ATM and you'll pay no fees. When I saw this account, I wanted to marry it. Although you need to open up a Schwab brokerage account to get all fees waived, you don't actually need to use that investment account. It can just sit there, empty, as you use the magnificent features in the checking account. You can deposit money by transfer, direct deposit, or mobile check deposit. But there is an important note. You can't deposit physical cash through this account. So if depositing cash is important, you'll need to pair this checking account with another checking account. In my case, I rarely use cash, and when I do, I'm withdrawing it, not depositing it. If I have extra cash, it's just sitting in my bedroom drawer. Oh God, please don't rob me. Your local bank's checking account with no